It's a great pleasure to welcome to the conversation Vitaly Golom. Vitaly is a serial entrepreneur in Silicon Valley since his teenage years and serves as the managing partner at GS Capital. He was previously a founding partner at HP Tech Ventures, the corporate venture arm of Silicon Valley's original startup, where he was recognized as a global corporate venturing rising star and a 3 times CEO. He's also a contributing writer to TechCrunch and a top-ranked mentor by accelerators and business schools in the US, Europe, and Asia. Vitaly lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. He is also the author of the book that is the subject of our conversation today, entitled Accelerated Startup, Everything You Need to Know to Make Your Startup Dreams Come True, From Idea to Product to Company. Vitaly, perhaps we can simply start with a question: why you wrote the book? What inspired you to do so?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be with you today. And with your audience, what inspired me to write the book is after many years, starting in my teenage years, just heard the intro. As an entrepreneur, I wore out a lot of knees on my hands, begging for money from investors, and made a lot of mistakes and learned a lot on how tech entrepreneurship works and what works and what doesn't. And as I shifted over to the other side of the table and became a mentor with a number of accelerators and venture funds, and then went into the venture business myself. So that would be my response, but looks like you're on mute.
Terrific. Thank you very much for that. And Vitaly, how would you summarize the key message or some of the key messages of the book itself?
Really, it's about capitalizing on the one most important resource that you have as an entrepreneur. Really, it's much easier these days to raise capital or invest money that you've saved up or hit up your friends and family if you're brave enough. But in reality, you are racing against the clock. And what that means is that you really need to focus your efforts. You're not going to be able to build a small version of a large company and build these departments and build all these big systems and structures in your company before it's due time. What you're trying to do is essentially do something nobody's ever done before in this particular business. You're identifying a problem, a particular customer, and you're trying to figure out the solution. Or you're trying to commercialize and bring to market some kind of a big tech innovation, a breakthrough. In all cases, you're going to have a lot more questions than answers. And the one thing that you can't get more of is time. So you really have to really focus on the important things, not just the things that make you feel like you're working, but you need to make progress. And the idea here is that you need to graduate from being a startup, which is really a kind of a heat-seeking missile trying to solve a particular problem. You're trying to figure out what business you're going to be in, how it's going on. Senior manager who have experience in various parts of the business that you don't, maybe that you do, but you need help in. And only then can you start building. And when you get to about 150 people, you become a real company. So the whole game here, the whole sport in tech entrepreneurship is to go from a hypothesis and experimentation as quickly as possible to something that's real, something that's generating revenue, something that's bringing value to a particular customer, which might be consumers, which might be other companies. and do that as quickly as possible. So you really have to focus your efforts and not waste any time on things that are not getting you closer to the goal.
What should come first, the money or the product?
Well, depends on who you ask. Venture investors and some angel investors are not really in the business of risk, right? They're in the business of removing risk. And certainly if you already have a product and some revenues and some first traction with customers and some proof points that this thing is working, somebody is finding value in this, they will pay you with their time or money, both. That certainly brings the risk down, right? So certainly investors want you to come to them with something that's as fully baked as possible. But obviously what you start with is an idea, right? But the most important thing is to as quickly as possible identify who your customer is that you're trying to help and what the problem is that they have that you're trying to solve and really work that equation and work towards that. The money will come, and my advice is always to chase customers, not investors, if you have the choice. Their capital is much more abundant than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, especially. So it will come. If you're chasing a valuable problem, spend a lot, most of your effort, as much effort as possible on your customers, and really surround yourself with experienced people that have raised capital before, that have built companies before, that can make the right connections and help you plug into the right type of investor at the appropriate time.
How should one think about the founding team and the equity that gets distributed at the beginning?
So I'll divide that question into two. I mean, first of all, your founding team is crucial, right? First of all, from an investor perspective, what we look at is to make sure that the team is complete and the team is qualified to solve this particular problem. And they have some kind of track record of success in the past. Sometimes we all hear these stories, and there's the Mark Zuckerbergs once every generation or so that come out of nowhere with no experience and are smart enough or lucky enough or both to build a large company. But in most cases, if you look statistically, you're going to have much more experienced people starting companies and have a much higher success rate in taking them to a big acquisition or all the way to an IPO, right? Building an enterprise. So that's one part of it. And really building a complete team as quickly as possible is very important. Also for your own mental well-being, I would not recommend, and I've done this myself before, I would not recommend starting a company by yourself. You need at least one co-founder. If for no other reason, just to have somebody to commiserate with and bounce ideas off of and always have the synergy. As far as equity, it's really important that your founding team is not too big, that you're not freely giving away equity, that you team up with the right lawyers that will help you set up the structure and governance from day one. And what that means is that every founder on the team has a vesting schedule. So over a course of usually about 4 years, whatever share of the company that you promise to each other, let's say you have two co-founders and they divide the company 50-50, they vest. So that means that if one of them decides to leave at some point, and this happens very, very often, one or both of the founders might end up leaving before those 4 years are up for various reasons. That they don't walk away with a big chunk of the company that you can't get back, right? And then have trouble. So even though you're co-founders and there's nobody else, you owe it to each other, if it's two people or three people or four people, whatever, that you're vesting and you're treating each other fairly. Now, separate also the idea of ownership in the company and then the roles and responsibilities, right? Those are really important separations. You're going to have one CEO, you're going to have one CTO, you're going to have one VP of marketing, and everybody has their responsibilities. They should be getting salary for this or something equivalent to the salary besides being a founder with equity, right? Even if you're deferring salary, just so everybody feels like they know what they're doing in the company, what the responsibilities are, that there's no hurt feelings, that everybody's a co-CEO. Those kind of things need to be avoided. And you need to be able to talk in the open, just like if you have a relationship with your life partner, you want to talk about things in the open. You don't want to hold any grudges or preconceived notions. It's very important to have that very healthy relationship as soon as possible from day one in the company. If you don't have that, your investors, if you have good investors with experience, will certainly bring that to the company with board governance. at one point or another, but it may be painful for you. So this is something that I cover in the book extensively, as far as finding co-founders and building those early teams, and how things should be structured and what people need to think about as they're building out their team.
How should one think about the mix of skill sets at the beginning? Does there need to be a technical co-founder? And, you know, how well should the co-founders know each other before actually jumping into something like a startup together?
I would say, I mean, for all intents and purposes these days, a startup means developing some kind of technology. It could be software-hardware combination of it. But usually there is some kind of technical element. You're using technology as a fulcrum, as leverage to disrupt an old business model, to make things 10 times faster, better, cheaper, et cetera, using technology that wasn't available before. That's essentially, if you were to describe a startup, that's what it is. You know, a new hotel or a new restaurant is not really a startup, because that's a lifestyle business that already has a predetermined way of doing it. And all you have to do is, you know, get a book from Amazon and follow the directions, right? Because many, many people have already figured out what model there is, with very few factors. But if you're working on a high value tech startup, technology is a big part of it. And your question, what was the second part of the question?
The second part, how long should the founders have known each other before jumping into this together?
Yes. So, you know, a lot of people put stock in this, well, we've been friends since we were kids and this and that. It's much more important to have a working relationship with each other and have compatible working styles than it is to have, let's say, necessarily compatible personality styles. Certainly, you will encounter situations that are highly stressful, highly frustrating, where people will react to them emotionally, because we're all people, we're not robots yet. And there's a certain way everybody reacts based on their personality. But in reality, if you have a choice, you know, work with somebody for a few years together. And if you work at a big company together and you really enjoy working with each other and you're good kind of work spouses, that's much more important. That's much better dynamic than just being friends, right? And you also want to really complement each other's skills to figure out what's missing, right? If two people or three people leave a company, they work together, one's a technologist, one's a salesperson, one's more of a driving the organization and kind of the project management piece, that's a good combination. And if you work together before and you've launched projects together before, you really hit the ground running when you're building something new from scratch.
What do you make of the lean startup methodology?
Lean startup is quite interesting. Eric Ries was a very good student of Steve Blank. I highly recommend everybody reads kind of the source material. Steve Blank was teaching at Stanford, and Eric was one of his students that that took that methodology and kind of simplified it and put it out there. It's great for product development, for rapidly focusing and balancing ideas off customers, and making sure that you're on the right track instead of spending 2 years building something that very well somebody might not need or nobody might need at the end. So it's really, really good as far as developing the products and figuring out the right features and how you can present it and this quick experimentation. Because in reality, with capital, you have a certain burn rate. You're spending a certain amount of money every month. And when you raise some capital, all you're doing is buying yourself some time. You don't have all the time in the world, even if you have all the money in the world, because if you're working on something interesting, you're going to have a lot of really good competition, people that are just as smart as you or smarter with more resources, more lucky than you, et cetera. So you really have to still race to get there. So this is a good discipline when you're using lean startup methodology to focus on the important things and not get bogged down or slowed down with unimportant things that don't make a difference to your customer, right? At the beginning, it's very much binary. You either figure out how to do this business and do it profitably and do it better than everybody else, or you don't, and your startup is done. So that's that. What lean startup doesn't really cover is all the other things they need to focus on, building the team, the financing and the strategy there and how you structure things. And when I was working on my book, when I outlined it at first, I actually wanted it to be kind of a soup to nuts comprehensive book where lean startup takes a deep dive into product development. I certainly covered that, but I wanted to cover from idea to getting to product and then all the way to building a large company out of it, which is a little bit more comprehensive and a little bit more of a general view on the entire experience of building a startup from idea.
In the book, you also write about accelerators or incubators, and you address the good, the bad, and the ugly. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, so accelerators, it's about 5 years ago now that I wrote an article that went quite viral on TechCrunch, talking about how accelerators are the new business school. And it's a really important concept. You know, you can look from two different directions. First of all, if you're a first-time founder, an accelerator is a great way for you to fill in a lot of the gaps in your knowledge and experience, professional experience that you might have. You might get into a good program where you'll be surrounded by advisors and mentors that have done it and been there and done that. So that's certainly helpful. It certainly gives you some structure to work through. What's not so great is on the flip side, for most accelerators, it's like running a free university, hoping that you're going to get a piece of a company, but in reality, only the top accelerators or top business schools, for example, or top law schools get the people that will consistently perform, right? So it is very much a zero-sum game. There are 400 or 500 accelerators around the world now, and I'm sure most of your audience can name a handful that everybody knows. So Y Combinator being the absolute number one, and they get kind of first dibs on the best companies. So the ones that don't get into Y Combinator will go on to the next tier of accelerators, of which there are a handful, like Alchemist, like Techstars, like 500 Startups, et cetera, that will pick up. And from an investment vehicle standpoint, you know, you're really betting on the kind of the power of large numbers. If an accelerator accepts, let's say, 100 companies in a year, they have to have some patience, and they have to think that, you know, one or two or five or 10 of those companies will turn into big success stories, because they are writing checks to each one, and then they're sitting there waiting. Essentially, there's a much better way to invest money, much more liquid way, much faster way to get the returns. So as an investment vehicle, accelerators are not very efficient at all, and a lot of them are realizing this. So from that perspective, you know, the good accelerators are really the ones that have that name brand, are surrounded by mentors that are really, really impressive, have done really incredible things, and can bring a lot of value to the company. So from perspective of a startup, you really want to chase those, even if they're not going to give you the best terms, even if they're going to not give you the most amount of money in those early seed days, but they will give you what you really need, which you can't get anywhere else. If you're, from a standpoint of accelerator, if you're looking at this as an investment operation and you think you're going to make it rich by investing in a bunch of companies that are really at idea stage, then you'll probably be very disappointed at some point. So that's kind of how you can look at it. On the other hand, kind of the really ugly part is you have some people that are, you know, they really could be bad actors, where they're trying to get too much of a company and trying to take advantage of entrepreneurs that might not be experienced, and really get a big chunk of the company. But in reality, they're also playing the lottery. So it kind of goes both ways. If the founder is not really savvy and they are, they're easily tricked to give up a big chunk of the company for a little bit of money, it's unlikely they're going to succeed anyway. So really it's, think of it that way. It's a great experience for founders to go through a top tier accelerator, even if that company doesn't succeed that they went through it with. They will get a lot of experience and contacts that they can use in the future. For the accelerators themselves, they certainly need great companies to kind of feed the beast, and great founders, even more so, with great ideas that will take things to the next level. So that's kind of the blend on accelerators. You can look at kind of the parallel with business schools. You have the Harvards and Stanfords and Oxfords of the world, and then you have the Trump universities of the world at the other end, right? Same thing goes for pretty much everything in between.
One of the toughest things seems to be once you start growing beyond that initial team and you need to actually start putting some structure and systems and processes in place. What is some advice for actually accomplishing that phase of growth?
It is very, very important. You have to look at a few different factors. You know, when you're a large company and you have a hiring plan and you bring another, first of all, it's by percentage, it's a very small part of your team. And you can afford to make a mistake, but it's also very clear what kind of set you need. When you're hiring a startup, you have to think about the future. It's very important. So you're hiring for capabilities and for personality fit with the rest of the team to be more productive and less disruptive. And you're trying to hire people that are a bit more generalist. They can wear multiple hats, right, at earlier stages of the company. Now, the other factor, too, is if you have a small team, let's say you have a team of 10 people and you bring on one more person, that's 10% of your company right there, right? So they each person at that stage will make a huge difference to the culture in the company, to how things are done, the productivity or lack thereof, etc. So it's incredibly difficult. One kind of rule of thumb to live by is hire slow and fire fast. Which means that you need to be really, really convinced and make sure that as much of your team has an opportunity to interview this person and get to know them and really, really grill them and see how they work and even maybe do a trial period where they work on a project with you. So you really get a sense of how to work with them and if everything is the way you expect it before you bring them on board and really depend on them. On the other hand, if you get signs that the person's disruptive, they're just not fitting in, their skill sets are not what you expected, or just the situation and needs of the company change, you really have to be much less emotional about this and cut ties as quickly as possible because you're spending time, you're spending money, but very little of it stays.
What is your view on remote teams? Because it seems like engineers, let's say, are so much cheaper outside of Silicon Valley, even in countries abroad, and yet may bring similar skill sets to the table. But obviously, managing a remote team might have challenges. How do you view that?
Well, say, look, you know, there's nothing that can replace being in the same room with a whiteboard with somebody solving problems together on the same time zone. Just really being in the experience, in the moment, present, and working on something that's really difficult or impossible to replicate remote. That said, a lot of companies, you don't really have a choice. In Bay Area, in Silicon Valley, engineering talent is hard to come by, very much in demand and very expensive. So for a lot of companies, especially early stage, it's very difficult to even compete. Even if you wanted to spend the money and the crazy salaries, you may not be able to attract the people that you need with the right level of skill set and experience. So inevitably, you will go outside to find those people. You might outsource or outstaff. And you have to deal with the challenge of different time zones, different language, cultures, et cetera. So certainly you will lose a lot of efficiency in that process. You cannot expect the same type of results as if everybody's in the same room. But that's the reality of the situation. You have to make the best of it. The best way to do that is to have a responsible party. Let's say the CTO that's local to the company, one of your co-founding team, whose job it is to kind of, if in or 12 o'clock every night, you know, local time and meeting with the team when they're most productive, then that's what it is. And making sure that you have a bit of cultural exchange and making sure that that remote office feels like they're really part of the team, which means bring them over to the main office for some time to work together, mixing the groups, doing some offsites, or flying to them regularly and spending time with the team. I did the same thing with my last company. I had a sales and marketing office in Bay Area where we were scaling that at a CTO locally. And then we ended up building out our own team in Kyiv, Ukraine almost half the company was there. And I spent a lot of time flying back and forth and going through the jet lag and all that. The CTO spent most evenings during the week up late talking with the team and solving problems. and you basically just have to do what you have to do. But expect that it will be a challenge and that you have to really spend that much more time and effort into managing the process than you would when the team is all in one place.
How much money is the right amount of money? How should one think about when and how to raise capital?
Well, that's both easy and very, very difficult. You basically need to raise enough money to get to the next milestone. What's the next milestone? That means different things at different stages of the company. But basically, you're looking to prove one big point, one big hypothesis, launch one big product, or get to revenue, or if you're an enterprise software, get a couple of big customers. So you need to figure out how much time and therefore money is it going to take to get to that next milestone. Make sure it's within the realm of reality, which is probably out of the context of our conversation today, because that's a long conversation as far as what's appropriate as far as range, but most people more or less realize what that is. And give yourself a buffer. It takes 6 to 12 months, sometimes more, to raise a round of funding. So that means that, let's say you put out the next milestone that you want to achieve in the next 12 months or 18 months, well, add at least 6 months to that of your burn rate for how much money you need to raise before you can upshift and go to that stage of your company. That's really the way to think about it. And then you really have to figure out who you're competing with, right? A typical VC will look at upwards of 500 companies per year. And you really need to figure out what's typical, what's market, and how do you not shock somebody with wanting to raise too much money or not enough money, and making sure that you get to that next milestone. So it's a bit of a juggling act where you have to balance your resources within reason, what's market, and get to that next milestone. That's very important. If you fall short of that milestone, it becomes incredibly difficult to raise capital. You're kind of in no man's land between rounds, where you spent the money that you raised, but you didn't achieve that next milestone. You're in for a lot of pain, or very likely going under and closing the business.
There's a view out there. It's a minority view put forth by Jason Fried and the Basecamp guys and some others, that basically talks about getting to profitability as quickly as possible and not really worrying about scaling fast and essentially trying to take as little venture money as possible. Do you think that's realistic in most cases?
I would say the headline answer is no, that's not realistic today in most challenges that people are going after. I'm a big fan of 37 Signals, that's now Basecamp, Jason and David there. They were pioneers at a certain point, but they are also, their lens is quite narrow. They are working in the world of small business software, and they launched when they had very little competition, and that's really their context. In today's world, capital raise and put to work at multi-trillion-dollar market, and your vision is to build a large company, an enterprise of the future, a company that produces hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue in 5 to 10 years, you're going to need to spend a lot of money to get there. That's just the reality of it. There are a few companies that get lucky and get to a very lofty revenue level and valuation and all of that on their own or close to it. Plenty of Fish was one example in the dating space a couple of years ago, where they didn't raise any capital, but then ended up selling the company for $500+ million. But that's not a realistic goal, right? That you really have to get lucky to get to that level. If you're going after something that's worth doing, you're going to need to raise progressively more capital to get there and to build a really big business. On the other hand, if your vision is not to build a really big business and you want to build a software company of 10, 20 people or 30 people and enjoy life and have what's called a lifestyle business in the industry, then by all means, and that's really what Basecamp and 37 Signals have built, they built a small company that doesn't really need outside support. They don't need to hire hundreds of people, and they're happy with their lifestyle that they've built for themselves over the last 20 years. good for them. And if you want to do that, good for you. But know that that is not the venture revenue model. That is not the business model for most technology innovations these days, because the idea there is to go from a concept and some hypothesis to a very valuable company producing hundreds of millions of dollars that can exit for $1 billion or go public and be the next big enterprise that will grow in the image of the Facebooks and the Googles of the world and the Ubers, et cetera. And that's really impossible to do without a lot of capital being invested.
Vitaly, before we wrap it up, is there anything I haven't asked that you would like to cover or share?
Well, I can certainly tell you about some of the things that I'm doing these days and post corporate venture world. I'm now on yet the third side of the table, which is investment banking. So what that means is that we work, my firm that I founded with my partner early last year, we work with great companies in very specific sectors on helping them raise capital when they're already at a pretty mature growth stage, when they're raising $10, $20, $200 million to get to the next level. That's something that we do a lot of. And then certainly M&A. So at a certain point, companies get to a certain juncture where they built some value, but the founders may be looking to move on and do something else in their career after 5-10 years. They figure out, you know, the board figures out that the best way for the next stage of the company is to become part of a larger company. That's when we do M&A process and find the right partner, the right buyer for these companies. And we have an office here in San Mateo in Bay Area. And we have people on the ground in Europe as well, working with some great companies like Hyperloop and Fisker. And that's what keeps me busy these days. The book will also be translated and released in Ukraine very soon, by the end of this year. I was born in Odessa, Ukraine, grew up in Cupertino, and now serve on the board of the Ukraine Venture Capital Association, where many of your listeners will likely recognize produces a lot of great technologists, a lot of great technology. So many, many companies have engineering teams in Ukraine now. So we're working on bringing more capital to the country so those founders don't have to leave right away. They can build great companies to the next stage of their development in Ukraine. And same thing's happening around the world. So it's not just Silicon Valley anymore, although Silicon Valley will be the leader hands down for the foreseeable future. But there's a lot of really interesting things and a lot of very smart, motivated people around the world working on really, really fascinating things. So I'll leave you with that. And I'm accessible on my website, golem.net, on Twitter, Vitaly G, on my public Facebook page. Happy to connect with your audience. And I hope you enjoy the book. It's available on Amazon and iBooks, electronic form, audio book, and physical book. So happy to connect, and hopefully everybody learns something that they didn't know before, and it helps them reach their goals a little bit faster.
Terrific. Well, Vitaly, thank you so much for your time and your insights today.
My pleasure.
And to everyone listening, thanks for being with us. Once again, the book is Accelerated Startup: Everything You Need to Know to Make Your Startup Dreams Come True, from Idea to Product to Company. Goodbye for now.